Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hey all, this is Ron with box number 7. You've probably been, clutching your pearls and adorning yourself in sackcloth and ashes out in the outskirts of the city with the dogs licking your boils in lamentation that I haven't had any contact up recently. Well, look no further. I am putting content up. I can't say it's going to be great content or, valid content or anything that has anything other than just bland oatmeal filler in it. But the idea about content creation is to make sure that you put something, some sort of caloric value into the bloodstream of your listenership. And so that's what I'm doing here. I do have excuses for it, or maybe not excuses, explanations. By the way, I am doing my little broadcast in front of, again, Kaleidoscope Coffee. Athens Avenue, Redding, California, home of a great, great, great in-house brew. You should stop by and get it. I'll put their information in the show notes. I like being able to say that because I hear so many other people that I listen to say that. Anyway. I'm going to turf it off on holiday season, Thanksgiving, days off, and schedule conflicts that I've had that I will explain. And I think that's what I chose really for the subject of my show today. And that has to be another show that I had. If you know me, this part isn't going to be a surprise. But if you don't know me, then there's going to be somewhat of kind of a new bit of information that you're going to find out about here. And that is, I am an entertainer. Well, maybe you already figured that part out. In my life, I have been a musician. I have played in bands. I have played in nightclubs and circuits. And I've done things where part of my living or at a couple of places, my entire living was forged out with a guitar and a microphone. And that's not what I'm up to now. I recently performed for all points and purposes, what you would call a magic act. But it's so much more than that. Let me just get to it. It was a show that I called In Search of Christmas Past. So what happened with me, let me go back, and if you don't know me, and this is going to bore you with a little bit of a biographical narrative, I apologize. I'll get back to making content that isn't about me, but for today, we're going to talk about my life and exposure and my Christmas past a little bit. When I was 5 and 6... my parents took me to a place in California, a now-defunct amusement park called Busch Gardens, and that was spelled B-U-S-C-H, I think it is, as in the hyphenated addendum to Anheuser-Busch Corporation. So it was essentially a set of gardens run by a beer corporation, and internally there was a set of rides that were comparable to Disneyland, including the first log ride I ever took. But one of the other features that they had was the live entertainment, and I distinctly remember sitting in some open amphitheater stands and watching magic shows with my dad. And I would watch, the magician put a box on a table And then next thing you know, after a couple of motions, he would open the box and a girl would be standing there in the box, and she wasn't there before. And I kind of liked it, but I also get a sense, if my retrograde memory isn't failing me, that I didn't really like what is called box illusions in the trade. And so we would go home, and I would see these magic shows on TV. Mark Wilson's Magic Land of Alakazam, where he did a combination of box illusions, stage illusions, and then what was called close-up magic, card tricks, tricks with sponge balls, tricks with cups and balls, many, many things that I come to know are very, very classically presented routines. And he wore the traditional tuxedo. His wife, Nanny Wilson, was his lovely assistant, and at times their very, very young son, Greg, would be there. What was interesting is that here I am 51 years later, and a couple of years ago I was at a place in Hollywood called the Magic Castle, and I'm walking with my friend John Hinton, who I hope to have as a guest on here, magician, entertainer, Christian man that he works a lot of faith-related circuits. But I was walking with him, and he was doing his very first performance in the Magic Castle, and I went down there exclusively to see him. And as we're walking, I saw a woman pushing a wheelchair, heading the other direction in the hallway, headed to the Peller Theater. And John goes, "That was Mark Wilson." And I'm like, "You have got to be kidding me." So I had to. Mark Wilson was the first magic book I ever owned. Mark Wilson's Encyclopedia of Magic, very famous, just a big, overloaded book that has a lot of great information, and it's undersold because it isn't vainglorious. It doesn't appeal to our short attention span culture now. But anyway, I could go off on diatribe after diatribe. So I looked at him, I go, "There is no way I am going to let Mark Wilson pass me in the hallway and not go up and meet him." So I went back and I stopped him, and it was his lovely wife, Nanny. You know, they were on their way, and it was so weird that Mark Wilson, who I believe was either in his 80s or 90s now, was predominantly, I think, confined to a wheelchair. At least he was not very, very mobile. And he still had enough child in him that he wanted to go and watch people perform at the Magic Castle. That was the thing that made me the happiest. The second thing that made me the happiest was the way I told him this and told him about his book and his influence and how happy he was. And I got to shake his hand. Unfortunately, photography isn't allowed inside the Magic Castle, so I did not get a picture with him. And he did pass away a reasonably short time later after that. I went to the Magic Castle Awards, a year and a half ago? I don't remember. And I went to see them, and that was in downtown L.A., and I saw Nanny Wilson with her son Greg and took a picture with them. And, of course, I explained how I met them in the Magic Castle and so on. Then that led me to a guy named Doug Henning. Now, Doug Henning was a guy who had kind of like a – he had the large hippie mustache. He had long hair parted down the middle, bell-bottom pants with the stars on them. Very much a parody of all of the Age of Aquarius chit-chat that was going on, at the end of the time where he really hit mainstream. And he also had some buck teeth, kind of, little buck teeth, but they were things that complemented his appearance. If you ever get a chance to just go to YouTube and look up Doug Henning, and you will see absolutely nothing but a joyous presentation of what I mean. He was the happy hippie. He was a man who wanted to make people smile. He wasn't interested in you thinking that he was in possession of magical powers. He was just using the pre-CGI effect that sleight of hand is able to have when telling a story and give that feeling to people. And he really was, for all points and purposes, he was my main wannabe influence at that period of time. Now, there's a significant wind out here, and I do apologize for that, but nonetheless here, I don't know if it's going to affect my audio quality. So I went and we moved up to Northern California, and by the age of 9, I had my first magic set. It was the kids' magic set, probably a Marshall Brodian magic set that came with the multiplying rabbits routine, which were basically a bunch of sponge rabbits, little flat ones that were cut out of some die-cut sort of thing, and a set of cups and balls. And by that, I mean 2.5-inch high plastic cups that stacked on top of each other. One was red, one was blue, one was yellow, and little tiny styrofoam balls. And you did the trick where you would put a ball on top of a cup, you would drop the cup on top of another top of the ball, and that cup would penetrate through the ball inexplicably. That would be a trick that I performed in the third grade at Happy Valley School in Anderson, California, Mrs. Sluice's class, room 3. Now, I don't know whatever happened to Mrs. Sluice. She left the school a few years later and fell off the planet, never been able to find her. I still am in contact with two of my elementary school teachers, my sixth grade and fifth grade teachers. Ironically, they are still teaching to this day. I'm 57, so do the math. All right, so I did my first and really last magic shows in the third grade. Kids can be brutal, your peers can be brutal, and you begin to find out that that a presentational framework for a magic trick is everything. So I grew up, adolescence hit, I forgot about all of it. I got into, the usual teenage things, distracted by music and girls. I was going to a private school. I was really into music. And in 77, when Elvis Presley died, the cataclysmic meteor that hit the culture when he passed away was something I had never seen. And I be honest, I still have never seen. Michael Jackson, despite all of the hullabaloo, despite all of the social media and the presence of the constant flow of information, his death still did not register the way Elvis Presley's did. And I really don't think I have a cloudy recollection of that. So anyway, I dropped magic for many, many years. All it ever became was I knew a couple of, little sleight of hand tricks that the kind where, you'd roll up a napkin and put it in your hand, and it literally became the kind of a magic trick where you were just showing off for, girls after a youth rally or after a school event or after church or something like that. So then years later, I was sitting having lunch with a friend in a place that no longer exists in here in good old Redding, California. It was called Sweet River Saloon, but now it's been through about 19 different failed business incarnations and now exists, in terms of this podcast, as a place called Kahuna's. So I'm sitting in there, and this young magician, basically a kid, and he was a kid compared to me. I guess I was in my 20s, so he would probably maybe been 17 or 18. Name is Dustin Coupe. I did look him up. I do see he is out there somewhere still performing, so maybe if he ever hears this, it'd be kind of cool. He walked up and asked to borrow a dollar bill from me that was sitting on the table that was going to be part of my tip for my food, and I said, sure. And then he borrowed a pencil from that was on the end of the table by the napkin holder, and he shoved the pencil through the dollar, and it went right through George Washington's face, and he ripped the pencil out the side and immediately handed me the dollar, and the dollar wasn't ripped. And I was flabbergasted how this could possibly be. I saw the pencil puncture the dollar. I saw the pencil rip out the side. So, and he said, hey, I'm doing a show tonight. If you want to come see it, it's a stage show. And I went, so I'm like, I came back that night. And I walked in, and I remember he was on stage, and this music started playing. And he Oddly enough, it was another trick with a dollar bill. But this time, it floated. He held it out in the air, and then it floated, and then he made little waving motions at it, and it floated away from him. And then it came back and all that. And I was, again, I was blown away. And at this point, you know, I realized I want to get back into this. I didn't know why. I think it's just because boys, especially, not just boys, but boys in general, have a phase where we think this stuff is cool. So I kept it in the back of my mind. A number of years later, just a few short years later, I am in Sacramento, and there's a magic shop. I decided I'm going to go in there, and I want to ask about these specific tricks. Now, I didn't think they were going to tell me, but what I didn't realize at the time, you know, they were a retail shop. And so if any of those tricks involved any sort of information that was marketed, in other words, whoever made those effects put them on the market with expressed permission that secrets can be sold, well, then they'll tell you. And I walked in, I said, I want to know about this pencil through the dollar. And they, oh, yeah. And they gave me the name of the effect. They told me the name of the guy that did it. And then they informed me that David Copperfield had performed the exact trick on one of his specials. And I went, okay, so I bought the secret. Then I asked, hey, what about the, I saw this guy float a dollar bill. I can't believe what I saw. And they showed me the secret for that. So about $60 later, I come out of that magic shop with that secret, the other secret, and then a couple of other secrets that would become far more practical to me later down the road. And such started my adult side journey of this. And so I would buy a trick. I would see a trick. I would buy a trick. And I spent a lot of money on singular tricks. Then when my dad saw that I was getting back into this, my dad would scour the TV guide, and he would videotape every magic show that would come on TV. And we had sort of a tradition through a few year period where the night before Thanksgiving in America, a show would air that was produced by Gary Ouellet called World's Greatest Magic. And it had this really great narrator voice that said, coming up next, Jeff McBride mixes masks and card magic, you know, stuff like that. And they really produced it well. And it was a mix of stage magic. And then what I would realize was my favorite thing in the world, close-up magic with playing cards. I knew there was something about playing cards that, and I know they're old, and I know they go way back, and they actually have, at times, controversial history, checkered history. Absolutely. So do dice. I mean, the casting of lots to part the raiment of Christ at the foot of the cross alone taints the nature of that type of thing. In one way, however, the children of Israel also had this little jacket they wore called the Umim and Thummim, which was another sort of prevaricator for them. Anyway, I see, this is what I'm talking about being tangentially distractible. So I realized I saw the guys that I really wanted to be like. And one was a guy named Bill Malone who was performing a lot of cool tricks. And a lot of them had gambling themes and cheating. Themes of deception. Themes of the historical nature of how people have lost their money and livelihoods by making what they call the Faustian bargain with the gambling devil. But then came a guy from Argentina. Now, he has since passed away. He's passed away quite a while. His name is René Lavon. And it was this suave, elderly, Argentinian cool cat that sold the deal. And I'll never forget the time that I was sitting in a fast food restaurant. It's called Carl's Jr. And on Cypress Avenue here in Redding. And I was just by myself. And I was I had just watched a copy of him performing a trick. I'll put the link to this trick in the show notes. It's called I Can't Do It Any Slower. And it was just a simple trick that I learned later in the magic trade is called oil and water. And here's the simple plot. You have three cards that are red. You have three cards that are black. You lay them down one at a time on top of each other, alternately, red, black, red, black, red, black. You then say, but oil and water don't mix. And you immediately flip the cards over and the reds are all together and the blacks are all together. Now, there are probably 1,000 variations, of that trick out there. But Renee's was the best one I've ever seen, and it is the best one that I have ever seen since. Here is the other aspect to why I thought he was so cool. Secondarily, not only was he from Argentina, not only did he have this tall, lanking, Sean Connery, cool cat vibe, he did his act in Spanish. He never attempted to appeal to the American audience by going into English, and there was a translator that translated everything he said. So that was another thing that added and compounded interest into why I think Rene Lavan is my biggest influence for pushing me over the edge. And the last thing about him has to do with the fact that he only had one arm. Now, he was born with two, but he had an industrial accident. It was a work-related accident that deprived him of the use of his other arm. I don't know how much of it may or may not have been missing. I believe he had it, but I don't believe that it was functioning. So every bit of his act, all of his shuffles were all done with one hand, riffle shuffles with the cascade effect, and then this trick, I can't do it any slower. And when I saw that, I realized that if I was going to do this, I want that. And so it led me not to buying individual tricks anymore, but to buy books. And I'm not going to go through my whole biography, but I wound up getting my hands on a book by a man who I would ultimately meet, I would ultimately correspond with, and who passed away here in the last year and a half, maybe. And his name was Darwin Ortiz. And he was one, in my opinion, one of the finest writers. Well, I got a hold of a book that had come out, and this was back in 96, I think, and it was called Card Shark. And in that book would lead me through the most magical reading. And when I mean magical, I mean nothing spiritual. I mean the mystery, the idea that he described a trick and said, this is what, when you come out of the end of this routine, this is what it should look like. And I began to practice, and I began to practice the techniques and the shuffles and the moves and the technical requirements that were there. And before I knew it, I was performing a routine out of there that is still my favorite card trick that I perform. And it is called the Hitchcock Aces, or in this book, the New Hitchcock Aces. He had previously written a different version of the trick in a previous book, but I hadn't known about it. So my card mastery took off, and I literally became that. It became where everything I was doing was 99% cards. The last thing that pushed me over the top in terms of starting to forge my own personality, stage personality, was I was working in a private Christian school, and this young man, I can't think of his name, he came up to me and he goes, my mom and I watched this show on HBO. I didn't have HBO, and he says, you need to see it. He goes, it's coming back on and we're going to tape it for you. And I went, cool. And he handed me a videotape. I still have the videotape that he handed me. I remember the kid's last name. He's probably 40 now, but his last name was Carroll. I want to say Stephen Carroll. If you're out there, I think that's your name, and thank you, because you changed a portion of my life for sure. And that was a show called Ricky Jay and His 52 Assistants. And if you are savvy, you realize that that stage title comes from the fact that he's using playing cards. Ricky Jay was a solo off-Broadway performance. He literally walks out with a deck of cards and begins an entire show and effectively uses a deck of cards and his incredibly refined rhetoric to entertain an audience. And the only place that he veers from playing cards is to perform what we magicians very, you know, it is a horrible cliche. We hate, it's actually, you know how people have these weird reactions to the sound of people chewing and breathing and those weird ASMR potential mental health issues? Well, we have one. And that's when we hear another magician say, I am going to perform for you the oldest trick in all of history. And it is fundamentally true, but it feels so cliched that we feel like we're stealing a joke from some stand-up comic from 500 years ago. And it is the trick. The trick is, and I mentioned it earlier, it is called the cups and balls. Now, this was actually the trick that I fell in love with the most. And in these scenarios, these man on the street interviews, they say, if you were just stranded on a deserted island and you could pick one book, what book would you be stranded with? And you get various answers. Some people say the Bible. Other people would say War and Peace. Other people would say Huckleberry Finn or Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, you know, classic novels. Well, I have that own scenario, that if I was going to be stranded on a deserted island and I only had one set of tools with which to work on variations of a routine, it would be the cups and balls. Now, this is the classic three cups and three balls scenario. There are variations. And so I decided I wasn't going to try to copy Ricky Jay, but I was going to attempt to, for the most part, create an act that only involves a deck of cards and maybe the cups. And now, if you see my show, it also involves the use of a piece of rope. So I went through years of performing tableside magic, street shows, corporate events. I did some trade shows where I'm trying to fit my magic around the commercial representation of something out there. And it went on and on and on and on for years. Sometimes I made decent money. I played in events. I played in houses that are in my own town that I didn't know existed for people that I didn't know existed. There are people in my town that look like they are the Addams Family. And they were really cool to me. And they paid really well. And I did my job. And they weren't weird. They just literally looked like they crawled off, you know, a Herman Munster lunchbox or something like that. That's a long time ago, so nobody's going to get who I'm talking about at this point. Then, in 2015, nearly 10 years ago, I decided that I was, instead of being the adjunct, the add-on to somebody's event, you know, like the Sir Optimus Club, where it's a luncheon and a bunch of people are sitting around talking about very, very boring, mind-numbing subjects. And then, oh, and by the way, we anachronistically brought this guy in to do some stuff that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. You have no idea how ill-fitting some of my shows were throughout the years. But I didn't care. I was like, to them goes the logistics. To me, I'll take the money. So at some point, I decided I am now good enough and mature enough that I have an identity. I went through various identities. I tried to be a comedy magician. I tried to be a kids magician. I tried to be a pickpocket magician, you know, where you steal watches. I still can steal watches and very occasionally do them, but not in my stand-up show. Street shows where I can easily cannibalize off of the demographics that are standing there and take a look at who's wearing watches and I bring them in and have them find someone who's comfortable enough to have their wrist touched while I put something in their hand and blah, 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 you know, for the sake of a trick. Ultimately, I didn't wind up being any of those guys. So I wound up being a guy who was, you know, somewhat of a low-grade smart aleck, articulate, well-read, love of history, an absolute love of history, particularly American history from the 1860s in the Old West, and then the history of deception. And so I decided I was going to put on my first ticketed shows. And so my very first show was in the December of 2015 at a place that no longer exists. It was called the Bohemian Art Loft. It held about 50 people per show. Little miniature box theater. And I had no idea there was that much public interest in what I was doing. So I went ahead and I booked a single show. You know, it was just going to be like a Friday night just to see if I could do it. Well, it sold out in a couple of hours once I put it on Facebook. Then Peter and Nadia call me, the people that were running that, and they said, you know, you've already sold out. We're done, and we've got requests. So we put in a second show. That one sold out in about sold a bunch of tickets at the outset, and then about a day and a half later, that one sold out. So I'm 100 tickets deep already. And so we added a third show, and that one was nearly sold out, but everybody that wanted to be at the show was satisfied. And the title of my show, and it's one that I have done a couple of times in various venues, called A Brief History of Deception. And it had enough of the Ricky Jay influence, but it wasn't Ricky Jay's material. It had an extended cups and balls routine that belonged to nobody but me. In fact, it was too long of a routine. I wrote too much. I talked too much. I've learned since then. But it was encouraging. And I got to walk away going, I literally got up and did me. I wasn't doing anybody else, and people paid to come see me. And so in the last 9 years, I have done many, many, many shows, and I wanted to do a Christmas show because Christmas has some of the most magical memories I have. And quite frankly, when it just seasonally, it has a magic and a grace to it. Now, I realize that it's commercialized. I realize that most of it is commercialized to the effect that it completely eliminates the birth of the Christ child. But there is a lot of goodwill that exists within its frameworks. And I wanted to always make a show around that. Now, what's funny is that one of the driving factors was something that happened in 2002. And that was I put a magic trick on the market. And my mistake was I probably should have never marketed it at all, but I did. And what it was this. So there is an effect in sleight of hand called the story deck routine. And that is where you are shuffling and cutting cards, and you're telling a story. And as you are telling the story, the cards that represent what you're talking about, like if you're talking about a guy living at the 1329 West 8th Street, you would put down an ace, 3, 2, 9, and an 8, right? But you're doing this while shuffling the deck, and so hopefully the people that are watching you control these cards are blown away, one, that you've memorized a story, two, that you can do it without any interruption, and three, that you're controlling cards while shuffling and cutting them. Well, most of the story deck routines are, they have a linear track, they are somewhat logical, but at the end of the day, they're silly. And I happened to be sitting in the middle of my living room in a place called Bella Vista, California, and I had a facsimile copy of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, and it was a giant facsimile copy that had the text of the book as published on the right-hand page, and on the left-hand page, it had every single facsimile handwritten page of Dickens' original manuscript. Well, I was so moved by the writing, the handwriting, and how much that manuscript must be worth on an auction market. And I'm looking down, and I have a deck of cards, 52 cards and two jokers. And I thought, is it possible to tell that entire story using a deck of cards? And I can't believe it, but about 2.5 hours later, I figured it out. And not only did I figure it out, I wrote the poem that is recited, because it's done in poetry. And not only that, I created a magic trick that happens at the very end. So I wound up writing it up as a manuscript. I went over to my buddy's house, my buddy David Blevins, and he took all these photos of my hands, because if you're going to put out a manuscript, you have to discuss techniques, you have to have photos and diagrams of exactly what moment certain things are happening. So I put it on the market, and it sold, you know, pretty well, I guess, as much as it did, and died off. The coolest part is I see my name in bibliographies and magic bibliographies at times, you know, because my trick was given enough of a nod, and the heavy hitters out there have at least heard of it. They'll recognize me off the book. They'll go, "Hey, you're the guy off the..." Yeah. So, anyway, that brings me down to this season, because I'm really cutting across the lawn of my biography here as far as this goes. A couple years ago, I was going to do a magic show called Apologies to Dickens, which was the name of my, believe it or not, the name of the routine I put out, since I was, bastardizing the text of Charles Dickens' original work. You know, whenever you alter somebody's work, you say, "with apologies to." And I thought, oh, Apologies to Dickens is such a cool title. And I went to run with that that show, and it was going to be performed at a place here in Reading called the Riverfront Playhouse, another really great place. And then I had an extreme dental emergency. I don't want to go into it, but just, you know, stuff happens, and it was going to require a months-long repair process before I was going to feel comfortable trying to articulate an entire show in front of a crowd, so I had to cancel on that. Then, as I started gauging interest for my shows, I did some other side shows in another place here in town called the Arts Theater. I did one in a place called... Cottonwood, that was their original site, Cottonwood, California, a little 35 or so seat black box theater. The problem was it was done in, those shows were in July, and we were having 113 degree Fahrenheit heat, and it was a non-air conditioned building that used a single swamp cooler, so there were problems, but I got through the shows. And it was a Western themed show called An Appointment in Deadwood, which is a show I'm going to bring back, and I'm hoping to do it in Deadwood, South Dakota sometime. Anyway, cut to 2024. I decide I'm going to throw a show down at the Arts Theater, which now exists on Hirsch Road in another place in Anderson, which is just north of Cottonwood, and I called it In Search of Christmas Past. And so it was basically this. I formulated a show in which... I was going to research the value, present the value of looking at the past, learning from the past, cherishing things about the past, and then applying it to now and the future. And so I opened with my routine, Apologies to Dickens, and started with that card trick, and it got a really great reception. And I've done it, I've performed it through the years, but I've never really done it in my own public stand-up shows. So the show basically took you through, went from there, and I talked about the story of Scrooge, and I talk about how the story of Scrooge's redemption is actually sort of almost a biblically redemptive process. The Ghost of Christmas Past, Christmas present, Christmas yet to come, and the threefold process of his traumatic journey that helped change him and alter the course of his heart and his life was threefold, almost like a death, burial, and resurrection, almost like when Luke writes about, you know, repenting and being baptized and resurrected in the spirit thing. We have this. And then you realize when you look around, everything that has a sense of completion to us has has a basis of three. You can't make a table without having at least three legs. As a matter of fact, a three-legged table, when constructed right, will be infinitely more stable than some four-legged tables. But we also embody past, present, and future. We are body, soul, and spirit. You have a complete logical statement is made up of the major premise, the minor premise, and the conclusion. Complete sentences have a subject, a predicate, and a copula. You know, you could go on and on. And you begin to see the significance of the number three just as a matter of structural completion. And then I realized how many of my routines, the ones that are classic, the ones that always appeal to an audience, always have three phases to them. And when you add a fourth phase, it takes something away. You know, they say this when you're writing, you know, in editing. Editing is not what you add. Editing is what you remove. Less is more is the old aphorism, and it's true. So I immediately go into a coin trick that involves three coins, and it's kind of silly, and I talk about how much I hate coin tricks while doing a coin trick that I actually kind of like. And then I do a lot of tricks that are based on that, and I use different concepts. I have a routine called 221B Baker Street, in which I bring someone up on stage with me, and I begin to make the assumptive leaps of what kind of a card player Sherlock Holmes would have been had he ever taken up gambling. And I go through the first one where I talk about I have a spectator cut the cards and hand them to me, and I tell them immediately how many cards are in my hand. I then have them pick a card, and I use their gestures. I ask them questions. Is your card red or black? And I use their gestures and micro expressions to read them and ultimately whittle it down and find out what card they're holding based upon the information they try not to give away, but ultimately do, because we don't really have control over our micro movements when we're lying. Then, of course, we have the part that is deductive reasoning in the classic sense of the book. And if you were going to apply deductive reasoning to playing cards, you're going to be dealing with card counting. And so I basically have the spectator grab a chunk of cards out of the deck. I then examine the rest of the deck, and using my brain power and memory techniques, I tell them what cards they are holding, and I call them out one at a time. Anyway, it ends ultimately with a tribute to the man who is really responsible for getting me in this, and that's my father. And I close the show out with a cups and balls routine that was written only a year and a half ago, maybe just at 2 years ago. And it's based on the night before Christmas, and it's a tribute to my father. He's mentioned in the routine, but I'm not going to over describe it here, but I just wanted to say that the entire act is something that I have written from top to bottom. It is large chunks of dialogue that has been memorized by me. And if you listen to this podcast enough, you realize that that writing and smart alecky rhetoric, esoteric gibberish and all kinds of incomprehensible muttering is part of my bedrock. It is kind of who I am. I love wordplay. Well, if I can do it extemporaneously like this, then I certainly can do it when I put it on paper. And then I also have been able to memorize things since I was a kid fairly well. So that's where I've been. So instead of looking up any words on, any updated words on the Ark of the Covenant, by the way, none of my mail has come back, not from Mar-a-Lago, not from the church in Ethiopia that is allegedly claiming to have the Ark of the Covenant, nor my letter back from the Vatican, in which I've attempted to find out if Yngwie Malmsteen is going to require an exorcism by their standards. And speaking of that subject, I am currently researching the real history of the young Bavarian girl behind the film The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Not The Exorcist. I'm going to touch on that movie, and I'm going to talk about it from the standpoint of its cultural impact, of its spiritual impact, and also Dementedly brilliant techniques that William Friedkin used, the director of the film, to really, in a sense, traumatize an audience. Not something I advocate, but there is a broader lens at which to look at the way we are affected by things. And also the knowledge bases that these people have had when they did this. Most things that you see happening in our culture are not accidents. Most of your ceremonial presentations, whether it's at the Super Bowl or at halftime shows, these are people who aren't just entertainers. They are people who genuinely believe in the symbolic underpinnings of what they're doing. You don't have to believe it, but they do. And what people believe should matter, at least in terms of how you're willing to absorb what they present to you. If I knew I had an airplane pilot that thought that, let's just put it this way. Let's go back to 9/11. If the people on that plane knew that the man that was going to force himself into a pilot's cabin was going to do what he did and understood what he believed and why he believed it, they would have never gotten on that plane. And so I think that in terms of culture, because culture, movies, books, music, everything that we do, and I'm immersed in it, all of it carries a worldview. And in reality, my show, In Search of Christmas Past, carried a worldview as well. That there is value in looking back. There is value in stopping and taking some lessons from the past. There is value in extracting the wisdom from those that are much older than us and applying it to the present and applying it to the future. And either heading off extreme heartbreak or even finding the road to ultimate redemption. So anyway, the original Bavarian girl from that movie, her name was Annalise Michel. It was in the night around 1976 when, there was an attempted set 52, I believe, exorcisms by a few Catholic priests who were ultimately put on trial for negligent homicide. Anyway, I'll go into all that because the backstory is very, very interesting, and the implications of how our culture always views that subject has an interesting outlook as well. Anyway, this is a haphazard and really long episode. I apologize. And that goes with no intro music today, but I'll do the outro music. So we'll talk to you next time from Kaleidoscope Coffee on Athens on a Sunday morning. This is box number 7.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.